Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller. When a man fired an assault rifle in a pizza restaurant earlier this month while, quote-unquote, investigating a conspiracy theory, the real threat of fake news became clear. Fake news is a term that's taken off in recent weeks to describe unfounded or fabricated news stories. Such stories were shared widely in the lead-up to the presidential election on social media. But now people are slapping the label on everything from hyperbolic tweets to anything that disagrees with their personal point of view. This hour, we're going to talk about fake news, what it is, how it happens, how to detect it, and what can be done about it. Joining me this hour are two guests. Will Arimus is Slate's senior technology writer. Welcome, Will.
Thanks for having me.
And Melissa Zimdars, assistant professor of communications at Merrimack College. Melissa, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
And later this hour, we'll be joined by lawyer and former journalist Stephen Aggregard. First off, Will Arimus, you recently wrote an article for Slate with the headline, "Stop Calling Everything Fake News." So let's talk about what exactly is fake news and what it isn't.
I'm glad you asked that first. There's so much talk about fake news, and people rarely stop to define the term. Fake news, as it's been used recently, referred to a specific phenomenon in which people were literally making up news stories and designing web pages so that they looked like real news sites, and then getting the people to share those very widely on Facebook. There have been reports that there were people in Macedonia. There was a cottage industry in a small town there where people were making up fake news for a living. It was largely news that catered to Donald Trump supporters during the election. A lot of it was negative news about Hillary Clinton. And it was stuff that they were basically just making up. In some cases, it was plagiarized from conspiracy sites. Other times, it was invented from whole cloth. They would publish it on a site that was designed to look like a news site. So instead of abcnews.com, there is a site, abcnews.com.co. And it would run a story like, Hillary Clinton has finally been arrested by the New York PD or something like that. And people would share this virally on Facebook. In fact, some analyses suggest that the most popular fake news stories were shared more widely than the most popular real news stories on Facebook in the months leading up to the November election.
That's a troubling idea.
Yeah, it's a little troubling, right? Since then, the term, as you implied, has been expanded to encompass a lot of other things besides news that was just made up. I have argued that we would be better served to talk about fake news, to use that term to refer only to news that's actually made up with the intent to mislead people into thinking it's real.
So when we talk about there are other things that people are accusing of being fake news, oftentimes showing up on sites that definitely have a conservative or a liberal spin. So how do you separate out something that say that you see something on a website, let's say like Breitbart News, and the fact, the lead, you know, there is a fact or two in there that's correct, but the story has a definite political spin on it. Does that qualify as fake news?
Well, I would argue it shouldn't qualify as fake news because the term fake implies counterfeit. It's something that is trying to pass itself off as other than what it is. So to me, that term is properly applied to stories that are made up and are trying to look like real news stories. But, of course, as the furor over fake news spread, the term began to be used in a lot of other ways. And so people started calling stuff that they disagreed with fake news. They started calling opinion and commentary fake news if they felt that it gave people a misleading point of view. They started calling mainstream news coverage fake news if it had a fact that was wrong, or even if it was completely factual, but they just felt that it spun the story in the wrong way. So recently, we've even had President-elect Donald Trump has referred to CNN coverage as fake news. He didn't like the fact that they were reporting on something his spokeswoman said about his role on The Apprentice. And today, Michael Flynn Jr., the son of his pick for national security advisor, who was in fact fired from Trump's staff a couple weeks ago for spreading the Pizzagate conspiracy, which I imagine we'll get further into in this program.
Mm-hmm.
He was calling a Washington Post report fake news. It was a report of an internal army investigation into his father. So he said the Post, you know, when the Post keeps running fake news, should it even be allowed to continue to operate?
Wow. Melissa Zimdars, you saw fake news becoming a problem with your students at Merrimack College. What happened?
So it wasn't just fake news. It was also the kind of news that's being talked about right now. So misleading news, other unreliable or clickbaity sources. But interestingly, the case that inspired me to create the guide was a weird mix of outright fake and conspiracy websites connected to politically leaning, more unreliable websites. So there was a story circulating that Newsweek created a cover that said Madam President. And this was being shared across dozens of websites saying it was evidence that Democrats and the mainstream media were working together to rig the election. But, of course, Newsweek created two covers, one saying President Trump, the other saying Madam President, to have both at the ready. So this became a fake story that originated and was shared by an editor at Breitbart News that led to a sketchy website, which is apparently home to the world's investigative truth. And then that was shared across numerous outright fake websites. So sometimes those bits of information travel across different kinds of sites, whether fake or, you know, political and somewhat misleading.
And you mentioned your guide. You actually came out with a guide to sort of how to figure out what's real and what's fake. And we're going to get into the details of that in just a minute. This hour, we're talking about fake news, what it is and how to detect it, how to maybe prevent it from happening in the first place. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call with your question or comment at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. You can also reach us online at nprnews.org/live. You know, what's the importance, Will Aremus, of separating out the fake from the propaganda or just the bad journalism or just the rumors and plain lies? I mean, why be very specific about what is fake news?
That's a good question. I think it's important for two reasons. The first is a pragmatic reason. So fake news is a largely solvable problem, I believe. Again, this is if we're using the narrow definition of news that's just made up. It's a, you know, some fly-by-night site that's trying to pass itself off as a real news site. There are relatively plausible ways that a platform like Facebook, which is where the fake news has been most widely shared, could limit the spread of that kind of fake news. It can do so through a combination of user reporting. It can do so by analyzing sharing patterns for given domains and given stories. It can build that into its algorithms. It can do it without, you know, it doesn't have to filter out or blacklist sites necessarily. It can use signals that are provided by its own users because fake news is something that we can have a consensus about. You know, it's you know, when a site that doesn't, you know, a site that doesn't exist or a publication that is not a real publication reports that the Pope has endorsed Donald Trump for president, mm-hmm. that's something that everybody should be able to agree is false if they just look into it a little bit. I mean, even the creators of these fake news sites, when they've been interviewed, have said, oh, yeah, we make this stuff up. You know, we didn't expect anybody to really believe it, but it turns out they did. So mm-hmm. this is a should be a nonpartisan problem. And so. But in order to solve it, we would have to limit it to stuff that is demonstrably fake. if we start trying to apply the term to stories that have a spin, or stories with a misleading headline, or stories that one side of the political spectrum or another finds objectionable for some reason, then it becomes an insoluble problem, because then you cannot achieve a consensus on what is fake news. Everything will get called fake news by somebody, and the result will be that when everything is fake news, then nothing's really fake news, because you can't distinguish anymore between what's fake news and what isn't. So the second reason is related, and I think it's just a simple matter of trying to preserve some element of one of the biggest things that's been lost in our public discourse over the years, and that is the ability to agree on a set of facts. I mean, if we can't, we're never going to agree on controversial issues. We're not going to agree on who has the right take on abortion or gun rights, or whether we should, how we should intervene, if at all, in Syria. Those are matters of legitimate debate, and they should continue to be matters of legitimate debate. But if we can't agree on whether the Pope endorsed Donald Trump for president, we're just really lost, I think. And I think, we have to be able to solve at least that problem to then be able to talk in an intelligent way about the really deeper and thornier problems of spin and propaganda and media bias and accuracy in the media.
Well, and Melissa Zimdars, isn't that the concern right now, is that we have youth out there who are less able to differentiate between fake and real news that they find on social media?
Yes, that's definitely a concern. Or they were having difficulty telling the difference between outright fake news and news that combines opinion and fact from a partisan perspective. And even some of them were worried, well, if legitimate news websites are reporting that CNN accidentally aired pornography and that news was actually a hoax based on a tweet, what do we do with those kinds of stories, which are basically fake or false news, but that are also being circulated by mainstream organizations? So I agree that it's completely thorny. And I think for media literacy, we need to be careful about the phrase fake news and how it's being used. But I also think we need to pay attention to these sources as a whole, as to help develop tools for navigating across them.
We're talking this hour about fake news, its rise in the recent months, and its impact on how we absorb information, what we trust, what we don't. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call with your question or comment at 651-227-6000 or toll free 1-800-242-2828. And of course, you can join us online at nprnews.org/live. Let's go to the phones. We've got Forrest on the line from Two Harbors. Forrest, welcome to the conversation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am a many-year newspaper editor in northern Minnesota. And I guess this whole notion of fake news, this has been going on for decades, literally, and it's just come to a head in my mind. As a newspaper editor of a community newspaper, credibility is that's your tool. That's who you are. Mm-hmm. And I'm watching this whole thing sully the profession of journalism. And it just tears at me that this, like I say, it's literally tearing away the fabric of journalism.
How is it doing that, Forrest? How do you feel that fake news is sullying your credibility?
Your credibility in a community, in the news cycle, it's dependent on truth, on getting the facts right. And for many years, I was at the Lake County News Chronicle for decades, and Two Harbors and Lake County, and I had an opinion piece every week. That was my opinion. Everybody knew where I was coming from. Mm-hmm. But the credibility of what are we covering, who said what is real and what isn't, that was found on our news pages. And people trusted that. And in this sense, this whole thing is just spiraled out of control, in a sense. That you can't trust reliable news sources. That's out there. That's what has swayed political opinion for decades now, and it's just come to a head here in this past year and a half, 2 years. It's distressing. it's distressing to me as a journalist, as a former journalist.
Mm. Forrest, thanks so much for your call. Do you think the stakes are higher now than they've been before because of this situation?
Yeah. I mean, the Twittering and the Facebooking and the sharing of social media. Yes, it has influenced how we as a people see our world. It has. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. How do you deal with this? I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I'm hoping the guests here provide some answers. It's just been distressing to many in the news business here. I'll put it that way.
So. All right. Thank you. Will Arimus, do you agree with what Forrest was saying there about how this is tearing at the reputation of journalism, mainstream journalism?
Yeah. I mean, it certainly is. And that's to some extent, I think, intentional. It's an intentional political strategy by some people who want to discredit the media. And of course, the media bears some responsibility here, too.
How so?
Let me back up just a second and say that I should be careful about using the term the media. I mean, I think, you know, we throw around this term the media as though it is a thing, and we're sort of reifying a broad class of different sorts of enterprises, from cable TV news to the New York Times to BuzzFeed to Breitbart to InfoWars. I mean, to call all of these the media is, I think, you know, this is another case where we want to define our terms a bit. So,
right.
So let me apologize for throwing around that term and say that I think we should be careful about it. But I think absolutely the trust in the media is at an all-time low right now. And the reason for that, I think, has to do with the fact that the media has become such a diverse thing. You know, when people say they don't trust the media, that doesn't mean that nobody trusts anyone in the media, but it means that, you know, 40% of people don't trust the New York Times and another 40% of people don't trust Fox News.
Right.
And so then you've got 80% of people who say they don't trust the media. But really what has happened is that the media has become so diverse we've really sort of blurred the distinctions between what is news, what is opinion, what is aggregation or blogging. And in the process, I think we've made it a lot harder for the average person to assess the credibility of a given source that they're reading. So, you know, when you open your Facebook feed, you'll see stories from all of those different media outlets sort of nestling side by side. They're all presented in identical format. And so a story from abcnews.com.co will look just like a story from the real ABC News, which will look just like a story from maybe an opinion site that has some radical political ideas. And so it just makes it awfully hard for anybody to agree on what is a reputable news source. And I think that is a problem. I think there are a lot of upsides. I don't want to undersell the upsides of the diversity of voices and sources of news that the web has brought us. But I think there is certainly a downside when we no longer, it's not just that we have different opinions, it's that we all have different facts to support our opinions.
We're also having this conversation online on social media, and NPR's Stephanie Curtis joins me now. So what's the latest online?
Emily says, your guest made the comment that fake news is something that could be fixed, and I want to push back on that idea. I think fake news is a symptom of something larger, not a cause. There's a schism in our society down to a fundamental level, and I think it's more nuanced than liberal versus conservative, but it was something of an approximation of that schism. There are people who hold fundamental beliefs about authority and trust in institutions, and there are people who have a basic and seemingly unalterable mistrust of these institutions. Fake news is a symptom of this. It is not the cause.
Interesting comment. Will Arimus, it sort of gets back to your saying that 40% distrust the New York Times and 40% distrust, the more conservative outlet. And so you have, you know, Fox News. And so you have that 80% schism going on there. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's something to that comment. I do think that there is maybe a a divide that's not just left-right. But I don't think it's as simple as there are people who believe in institutions and people who mistrust institutions. Again, you know, it depends on the institution and it depends on the person. If you are a liberal, you might place a lot of trust in the institution of the New York Times. You might trust place a lot of trust in the institution of the Environmental Protection Agency. If you're a conservative, you might have deep mistrust of both of those institutions, but you might place trust in a Donald Trump White House, or you might place trust in James Comey's FBI. So I don't think it's quite as simple as you know, trusting in institutions versus mistrusting institutions.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Kenneth on the line in Minneapolis. Kenneth, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call first off, but
sure.
I'm just calling. I'd like to know how can we actually help combat the not spread of fake news, but the ability to have not just adults, but kids learn like a critical thinking of looking at something and being like, wow, that's unbelievable. And then the next step being like, well, maybe it is unbelievable. Maybe it's an untruth or not a truth. And then investigating it themselves, looking into it, and developing the skills of being able to analyze every problem and developing it in a way of, you know, being like, oh, that isn't true. After I looked into this, it turns out that this is a fake news story, not just being able to look at it .com.co, because that is always a good, you know, indication of that being an incorrect story or fake news, but actually addressing the problem, starting with our children, building their critical thinking skills and ability to analyze a problem. That's one thing I learned in school in geology was to, you know, when you hear something that is makes you say out loud, that's unbelievable, you will then look into that problem and make sure what has just been said is actually accredited by, you know, it doesn't have to be a scientific journal, but a journal of a, you know, credibility, something that actually has credit to it.
All right, Kenneth, thanks so much for your question. Melissa Zimdars, how do we teach our kids to be able to differentiate between fake news and quality information?
So there's a lot of different steps that readers can take. And the first are perhaps very obvious, but one is just to read widely. So you can sort of safeguard against, being tricked by a fake news site or even a truthy news site if you just make sure you have a diverse media diet. Similarly, when you read a story, if you find that it makes you really angry, if the language is very sensational and strong, it's probably a good idea to keep reading other sources. And then interestingly, I've analyzed about 400 websites over the last month, and a lot of them contain about us sections or disclaimers. And so that's a good way to identify if it's satirical fake news, which is offers important social commentary. And usually if there's no about us, if there's no contact information at all, that's a sign that the site is illegitimate. Also, if the same author publishes each piece, or if there's no author at all, those are normally red flags to keep reading somewhere else, probably.
So we have some basic tips there, but what about critical thinking? That's a way to navigate the sites we're seeing now. But in school, do we need to be teaching critical thinking in a way that's more in-depth or rigorous?
Well, I think we do, but I think this connects to huge debates about public education and budget cuts and what we can teach with the time and tools that we have already. There are a lot of media literacy programs that work to reach grade schoolers and middle schoolers and high schoolers, but I have been teaching at the college level for 8 years, and oftentimes a communication or media class at that level is the first time students are exposed to media literacy at all. So clearly it's not as widespread as it needs to be.
Will Arimas, should we be just calling this propaganda instead of fake news?
Well, I would actually argue that those are two different things. There's not a bright line between them. It can be blurry, but I think they are better addressed separately to some extent, because again, the fake news is a relatively small and limited problem by my narrow definition. The news that's just made up, and yes, it was shared incredibly widely on Facebook. That's partly due to the way Facebook's algorithms work. Professor Zimdars raised a good point earlier that if something makes you really, it's written in angry language, or it makes you really upset, or invokes strong feelings, it's a good idea to keep reading. I mean, Facebook is set up to circulate widely stories that do engender those strong feelings in people, because those are the ones where people say, they read it in their feed and say, yeah, God, I'm fired up, and they hit like and they share it with all their friends before they've even, often before they've even read the piece, let alone looked into whether it's a credible source. So I think that the issue of fake news is one that that Facebook can help address. Google may have a role. I think there are ways around that. I think propaganda is a deeper and more serious problem. It's not as easy to fix, and I do think the answer has to be some. There has to be some component that has to do with media literacy and education, and helping people to understand the importance of critical thinking about what you read in the media, but also maybe give people better tools to interpret and assess the credibility of what they're reading in various media. I just think, journalists tend to assume that everybody understands the difference between news and opinion, between original reporting and aggregation, but that's often not the case, and there's a big disconnect between what we as journalists assume about our readership and what our readers actually have been told or understand about the distinctions in various sorts of journalism. I don't know what the answer is, but I think the answer has to involve critical thinking, media literacy, and that sort of thing.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got John on the line from Eden Prairie. John, welcome. What's your comment or question?
Hi. So yeah, we were just talking about the Facebook and Twitter as another example. One of the things that I wanted to comment on here was the fact that I don't think those sources should be responsible in actually figuring out what the fake news is and what it is not, especially since we've been having this discussion this morning about how difficult it can be to determine what's fake news. I just think that could cause a large problem and in some ways what I'm going to call government overreach, in some ways of ordering that these companies that, social media companies have to monitor what people are posting on them.
Great comment, John. Thanks for that. Yeah, well, Mark Zuckerberg is suddenly finding himself to be editor-in-chief of news that we consume on social media. That's not something he set out and trained for.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good point, and it's not something that he wants. He certainly does not want to be. He doesn't want Facebook to be in the role of arbiter of what is true and what's not, what's good journalism and what's bad journalism. Facebook is a platform that wants to cater to everybody, regardless of political ideology. So Mark Zuckerberg has really resisted calls for Facebook to take more responsibility for the content that appears on its platform. Now, I think there is something legitimate to that in the sense that we don't want, we don't necessarily want Facebook to be a media company in the same way that the Washington Post or CNN or Fox News is a media company with human editors deciding what we should and shouldn't see at all times. On the other hand, Facebook's algorithms are not neutral. I mean, Facebook likes to portray itself as this sort of neutral technology platform. It's just a tool that people can use, and anything can be shared and has an equal chance of being shared. As I discussed earlier, Facebook is actually not a neutral platform. Its algorithms are biased in favor of certain types of content over others, and this has been a problem Facebook has struggled with from the beginning. If you trace the history of the news feed and Facebook's influence on the media, you can actually see how it has influenced the media coverage itself. Before Facebook, news headlines used to be about summarizing the article below them for the most part. But Facebook, it changed the incentives because on Facebook, you are only going to click the story whose headline really grabs you. You're going to share a story whose headline is something that you immediately agree with or that appeals to your biases or your pre-existing sentiments. And so the media actually started changing the way it wrote headlines in order to reach people on Facebook.
Or writing things that are share-worthy as opposed to newsworthy.
Exactly. And, right, you know, writing headlines that are clickable rather than informative. So Facebook does already plays an active role, whether it wants to or not, in shaping the news. And so I think what is fair to ask of Facebook is not that they try to decide what is true and false, but they examine the ways that Facebook's own algorithm biases the distribution of news in favor of certain types of content over others, and that they try to provide some counterweights to avoid distorting the news more than, you know, more than it already is on its own.
But isn't our caller's concern legitimate that when you say, okay, let's use our algorithms and also a team of journalists to figure out what exactly merits being posted and what shouldn't be shared? Isn't there a risk there that suddenly only mainstream ideas and news outlets are being shared, and we lose the diverse sort of fringe voices that are always sort of pulling us in different directions away from just what's mainstream?
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly why I've argued so strongly. I think we're circling back to why I argued in the first place that we should keep fake news to a narrow definition, because we don't want, you know, in the effort to keep fake news from dominating Facebook, we don't want to drown out a diversity of voices. We don't want to prevent people from sharing stuff that they, you know, that they legitimately believe. I think that would be a terrible outcome and a sort of overreach that we really need to be careful about. But, you know, again, if we're just talking about fake news, that's not such a hard problem. I think it's easy to overstate how hard it is. We have, you know, any major email service, just to use an analogy here, any major email service uses machine learning algorithms to identify spam and to filter it out of your feed. That doesn't mean it has humans going through and deciding what emails are legitimate for you to read and what emails are not legitimate for you to read, or censoring your email. There are ways that they can examine the content of an email. They can look at the patterns in who's sending it and what the recipient list is, and they can, with a really high degree of accuracy, they can tell what's spam. Especially, you know, Gmail is really good at this. If you look in your spam folder, I look in there, I'll look at 100 emails, and 100 of them will be, in fact, spam. So I'm talking about something more like a spam filter that's filtering out the stuff that is obviously fake, that really is not what it purports to be. I'm not talking about human editors going in and deciding which journalism deserves to be read by people and which doesn't.
We're talking this hour about fake news here on NPR. My guests are Will Oremus, Slate's senior technology writer, and Melissa Zimdars, assistant professor of communication at Merrimack College. And we're going to keep talking as we after the news here. We appreciate your calls. We know we've got a lot of them lined up, and we'll get to them after the news. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 651-227-6000 or toll-free 1-800-242-6000. 2828, and of course online at mprnews.org/live. But first, it's time for a check of news headlines with Phil Picardi. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Mariana. UN Commission investigating human rights abuses in Syria says it is imperative to make sure civilians are granted safe passage out of eastern Aleppo. The panel says the Syrian government and its allies bear primary responsibility for preventing rights violations and reprisals in the area. It says it's continuing to receive reports of violations by pro-government forces. Meanwhile, the Russian military says Syrian troops have seized another district in eastern Aleppo, reducing the area still under rebel control to less than a square mile. The commander of U.S. land troops in Europe says an armored brigade has started moving out of its base in Colorado to be deployed in Poland. The U.S. has decided to speed up the deployment because of increased military operations in the region by Russia. Poland and the Baltics request presence on their territory by U.S. and NATO troops. At a rally yesterday in Wisconsin, President-elect Donald Trump praised House Speaker Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan. Trump said Ryan was like a fine wine and that each day he appreciates what he calls Ryan's genius more and more. However, Trump added, if he ever goes against me, I'm not going to say that. Trump and Ryan were at odds during the campaign, but since the election, Ryan has said he is all in for Trump. Today, Trump's transition team confirms he has chosen former Texas Governor Rick Perry to head the Energy Department. And the Federal Reserve is expected to raise its key interest rate for the first time in a year today. Policymakers are wrapping up their two-day meeting this afternoon, and Fed Chair Janet Yellen is expected to announce that the interest rate will increase from 0.5% to 0.75%. That'll likely nudge up the cost of some consumer and business loans. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:40.
Every Wednesday on All Things Considered, get a taste of regional food and drink trends, reviews, recipes, and advice. Our stable of food experts serve it up on Appetites. I'm Tom Cran. What's news and what's for dinner? Join me starting at 3.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs in for Carrie Miller. And we're talking this hour about fake news. Stephanie Curtis is hosting the conversation online. Stephanie, you got a comment in there you'd
yes.
like to share?
Yes. Patrick says, I'd like to propose the opposite of what a lot of people online have been proposing, which is that we need to teach our children. What we do is teach our parents that certain sites are not truthful or are conspiracy sites. My mother is an avid fan of Alex Jones and his site InfoWars. And let's just take this as no one actually has to answer this question. I think Patrick is just crying out. How do we try to combat this kind of misinformation with our parents, whom I tend to find to be the biggest perpetrators of spreading fake news and conspiracies?
Yeah, I had a colleague the other day who said that, you know, it used to be that your mom didn't want to ever make a purchase online, and now she's sharing stories from goodness knows where, saying, can you believe this? So our relationship to the internet has changed dramatically over the years. This hour, we're talking about fake news, what it is, how to detect it, what to do about it. My guests this hour are Will Oremus. He's a Slate's senior technology writer in New York City. And Melissa Zimdar. She's assistant professor of communication at Merrimack College. She joins us from Somerville, Massachusetts. And we're now joined in studio by Steve Aggregard, former Pioneer Press reporter and a lawyer at Bassford Remley. Steve, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Marianne. Thanks for having me.
You know, we had a caller earlier in the hour who unfortunately wasn't able to stay with us who asked, could Hillary Clinton bring libel action against somebody who tweeted or posted about Pizzagate and the child porn ring?
That is a great question. The answer to that is sure, she could try and bring a defamation action. Would she succeed in the end? Probably not. Maybe the most misunderstood aspect of fake news and how it interacts with the law is the effect of defamation law and how it might intersect with fake news. Defamation protects a person's character. So if falsities are uttered about something false said about a person, that person could go to court and sue. So technically, theoretically, Hillary Clinton could go to court probably and sue over Pizzagate because false things were said about her. But, you know, she is a public official, a public figure, and legally, public officials and public figures have very high bars to cross to be able to succeed in a libel or defamation action. And she'd need to prove some damages. It would be a tough row to hoe, shall we say. But theoretically, sure, it's there.
Other legality issues. I mean, people are – we talked about earlier the fact that it's possible that 60% of news stories that were shared on Facebook in the lead up to the election were actually fake news stories. Is there a legal case to be made about the legitimacy of the presidential election because of all these fake news stories?
Well, perhaps, but I think more of the discussion and more of the focus has been on websites like Facebook that have essentially served as conduits for some of this fake news to propagate, if you will. Fake news or Facebook has been identified maybe as a problem, and I heard your guest suggest that maybe there is a solution there that Facebook could take on a role to do something about this situation. That may be true, but Marianne, what is important to remember is the law is probably very unlikely to intervene to force Facebook to do something like that. There's a law in the books. It's a federal law. It's Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and it says that websites that essentially allow for any content to be seen and read and shared online, they're generally immune from lawsuits over pretty much anything. So rest assured that Facebook has lawyers standing in the wings, ready to aggressively enforce Facebook's rights. And so having the government intervene in this sort of situation, even when we have core political issues at bay, and arguably the election, and some saying at least that its legitimacy is questioned, it's still going to be a tough row to hoe to try and get the law to do something.
So fake news, does it fall under the freedom of speech protections then?
It does, generally. As the law exists right now, at least. Maybe the law will evolve to change. Now, there's an important caveat, which your caller earlier drew attention to. Defamation could be fake news. But when you have a situation where fake news is spread and it does not harm someone's character, generally there are going to be some protections there. Now, there's an important exception that has been developing the last few years in the law, and that is when fake content, whether it be news or advertorial, which is sort of a mixture of advertising and news, whether that entices somebody to buy a product. Then the Federal Trade Commission, which regulates these sorts of things, and state laws, Minnesota has laws that outlaw deceptive trade practices, those sorts of things. When fake news is propagated to persuade people to buy things, great example is dietary aids. There's been litigation the last few years nationally over dietary aids that have been marketed under the guise of fake news. Well, the Federal Trade Commission has been stepping in and taking action there to do something about it.
But we're talking about people buying into ideas. And isn't that much more volatile and dangerous than, say, buying a product?
Absolutely. Hit the nail on the head. And the constitutional protection the Constitution protects satire and it protects opinion. And as your guests have alluded to, the line between satire and fake news can be difficult to discern. The websites like The Onion share a role in this problem, to be honest with you. Even The Daily Show and some of the media that folks on the left have consumed, quite honestly, has helped to fuel this issue. But where is that line between satire and fake news? That is what the law is going to have to struggle with, and for which there is no good answer right now. So we'll see how this unfolds. It's still evolving.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Billy on the line in Duluth. Billy, welcome.
Hi there.
Hey there. What's your comment or question?
I was just saying to your producer that this is also solvable in that fake news exists on social media. If you get your news from social media, you are not an informed person. I can tell how informed people are by what's on their phone. If all you have is Facebook and Twitter, you're not informed. You have to go and download the apps of all the news sites, everyone, NPR, BBC, Al Jazeera, everything, the left, the right, everything. And you have to visit those sites. There are no fake news on their sites. It's all on social media. And so if somebody wants to try and argue with me, I can basically say, let me see your phone. And if they don't have any news app, if they have no news apps on it, I'll hand it back and say, I'm not having this discussion with you.
Oh, wow.
You're not informed. And so if you want to be informed, get the apps, go to the apps. When you're tootling around, instead of just sitting on Facebook and assuming that you're informed, go to the sites. If something comes up, go to all the sites and see what you can come up with. Social media is not news, period.
Thank you for your call, Billy. Really appreciate it. Melissa Zimdars, what do you think?
Well, I think when we think about fake news, it can also be conspiracy sites and junk science sites. So when we think about like selling products, those products are also selling ideas. And one of the websites I was most concerned about is called Natural News. And they peddle a lot of basically fake news, but more so news that straddles this weird truthy, false, true, very misleading medical information. And so those websites are really hard to categorize. And I think they do as great of a disservice to our public discourse as outright fake news.
Yeah, and let's talk about the fact that, you know, this is not something we've talked a lot about stories aimed at conservatives trashing Hillary, but this is not a Republican-only kind of phenomenon. We have seen this in the liberal sphere as well, right, Awilo Remus?
You know, yes.
I'm thinking yes, vaccinations. You know,
yes, absolutely. Okay, that's an excellent point. So actually, before the fake news discussion revolved around political news, it revolved, as Professor Zimdar has alluded to, it revolved around nutritional and health news. There were these hoax sites that were finding a lot of traction on Facebook by, you know, advocating that, I don't know, like, you know, if you eat bananas, it'll cure cancer or something like that. So, you know, that was a form of fake news that predated this form. Can you remind me what your question was?
Oh, sorry. So I was just saying that, you know, this is not something that's limited to one side of the political aisle. This is, you know, people on both sides of the aisle are, you know, whether you're liberal or conservative, there are people out there who are consuming fake news readily.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and in fact, a lot of the people who were in the sort of, you know, anti-vaccine crowd who were spreading false or deeply misleading stories about the effects of vaccines, you know, a lot of them identify as very liberal. So certainly there are people on both sides of the political spectrum who are prone to falling for conspiracy theories or to not vetting the information that they're receiving on social media. I think the evidence suggests that during this particular campaign, for whatever reason, fake news that appealed to Trump supporters was circulated far more widely than fake news that appealed to Clinton supporters. Hmm. Now, you could read this, and I'm sure a lot of liberals will read this as evidence that Trump supporters are more gullible or that they don't care about the truth. There may also be an element of Trump supporters are less likely to have faith in mainstream media organizations because they believe that they are liberally biased, and so they're more receptive to non-established sites, which leaves them open to being deceived by fake news sites. If you wanted to put a pro-Trump spin on it, you could say it's because, you know, maybe it's partly the enthusiasm gap. I mean, Trump supporters were just more fired up in this election, by and large, than Clinton supporters were. Maybe that's why they were the ones who were sharing it more widely. But both an analysis of the data and anecdotal interviews with people who created fake news strongly suggest that it was not a you know, you don't want to draw a false equivalence here. It was not the same on both sides. The people who created fake news almost universally said, you know, we tried to make fake news for the pro-Clinton crowd, and some people bought it, but we just found that there was a lot more money in the fake news that was anti-Clinton or pro-Trump. That just seemed to work better for whatever reason.
And, you know, these tips, Melissa Zimdars, you were sharing tips about, you know, check the domain name, read the About Us section, you know, in terms of determining what's fake news. These are great tips for people who don't want to be duped by fake news, but there are also those people who like reading stories that uphold their personal beliefs and concerns. How do you convince them that facts are their friends, Melissa?
I think that's going to be a question that will take years of additional communication and psychology research to a certain extent. But my hope is that if mainstream journalists, right, working for some of these major corporations can start reflecting a little bit more on their practices, if we can collectively start supporting local and state media the way we once did, and they can start reporting on stories that are less about immediacy and, you know, sensationalism and more about, you know, what we need rather than what we want, maybe we can start bringing some of those people back into the fold, back into the more reliable infosphere. But I think that will take a lot of work and likely many, many years.
You know, we've been talking about how it happens and who consumes it, and how this is affecting or eroding at the journalism, at mainstream journalism. But I think it's really interesting to talk about trust along we've mentioned that trust was, what I want to say, a lack of trust in journalists is part of what created the appetite for fake news. And so it also seems like this is a downward spiral where, as a result of fake news, people are even less trusting of what they see or read out there. Will, how do you work trust back in?
Oh, man. You're asking the hard questions, aren't you?
Sorry.
I know. That's
it's
great.
It's what I'm thinking about these days.
Yeah, I don't know how you do it. I mean, it is a combination, I think, of at least two factors. One is that, there is some extent to which the mainstream media have brought this erosion of trust upon themselves. You can maybe blame Facebook and its algorithms for part of it. You can blame the internet, which has disrupted mainstream media business models. But, you know, the mainstream media has never been perfect. It has always been subject to the biases of the editors and journalists who work for these organizations. It always will be. They don't always neatly fall onto one side of the political spectrum, but the mainstream media will never be perfect. So I'm not sure that you know, making mainstream media perfect is the answer. I do think that trying to avoid sensationalist headlines, trying to focus more on serious issues, being more concerned with accuracy than speed, all of these things are things that the media could do to help themselves in terms of gaining the public's trust. But there's another factor here, which is that there are people in the political system who do not want the public to trust the mainstream media, because when the public do trust the mainstream media, then they can't get away with stuff. They can't get away with lies. They can't get away with corruption. They can't get away with propaganda, because it will be debunked. And so there has been, in my belief, a concerted, sustained effort over the years from conspiracy theorists on both sides, but especially the right, and to discredit the mainstream media. And I think it's partly for this reason, because when people don't trust CNN, don't trust the New York Times, don't trust the Washington Post, in this campaign, you even had people on the right starting to mistrust Fox News because they thought it was too liberal or too anti-Trump, then you are opening up the field for any information to stand on equal footing. You know, when nothing is credible, then anything can be believed. And I think there are people who really stand to benefit from that.
We have time for just one last caller, Bob from Canby. If you could ask your question or make your comment briefly.
Yeah, I would say that necessarily Trump in the presidential campaign had such a propaganda machine. He kept saying all these negative things over and over and over that weren't true, really, about Hillary Clinton. And this propaganda really is akin to the far right beginnings to Nazism almost. I mean, it's frightful. If someone says something often enough, it becomes true. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the internet aside, there's a level of obviousness really when it comes to the internet in that a lot of it is fake or not true.
Okay. Bob, thanks so much for your comment. Will Oremus, how do you fight fake news when you're dealing with a president who also seems to, you know, be comfortable telling transparent lies, you know, putting out transparent lies on Twitter and elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was sort of saying this without naming names in the last comment. But
go ahead.
If you are a person, hypothetically, let's imagine there were a person running for office whose MO, whose modus operandi was to tell lies that are relatively easily debunked. It is absolutely in your interest for people to not trust the mainstream media, so that when they try to debunk your lies, you can call them liars instead. You can say that actually it's CNN and the Washington Post that are the real fake news. No one should trust them. I think it is a scary time, and it's also going to challenge the media more than ever, because when you are the New York Times and you're faced with this loss of credibility, how do you cover it when the president-elect says something that you know not to be true? Do you come out and call it a lie and risk being seen as liberally biased, or do you try to soft-pedal it and use euphemisms and you know, try to avoid the perception of bias, but then maybe miss the truth? And I think that is a real danger in the coming 4 years.
This hour has just flown by, you guys. Thank you so much. This has been a fascinating conversation. We've been talking about fake news with Will Oremus. He's Slate's senior technology writer. And Melissa Zimdars, assistant professor of communication at Merrimack College in Somerville, Massachusetts, and lawyer Steve Aggregard. He's a lawyer at Bassford Remley and a former Pioneer Press reporter. Thanks so much to all of you. And stay tuned. We've got more coming up next. We'll be hearing from Philip Rennell and Vocal Essence as they sing some pretty interesting Christmas carols, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It's coming up next.